is one-sided. So remember, there's another side to it, if not 5 million other sides to it. When I was working on it, I named this talk Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And I better say something about that. I have a tendency, I guess I've got a sentimental memory, but when I have to name something or try to describe in a clever way how something works, I try to pull out of my memory a line from an old song that used to be popular or the title of it. And you'll see it happens several times in this talk. I just noticed as I have it. For instance, I was thinking about this financial meltdown we're going through, and I thought, if I was giving a talk on that, I'd call it, "We'll have fun, fun, fun till Daddy takes the T-bird away." Thank you, Beach Boys. Right on, every time. But anyhow, I was thinking about how we all wind up coming to, can come to Zen practice. And recalling my own experience and what I know about other people's experience, I would say that most people, when they first come, don't really know why they're here. Maybe someone told them it would be good for them, or they would like it, or they read some Zen books, or they met the teacher and they kind of liked the teacher, but they don't really, in any sort of deep sense, know why they're there. It's very rare that somebody comes that fully prepared, usually it's because they've been involved in other spiritual paths. That's the good news, that you don't know what you're doing. The bad news is that sooner or later, find yourself complaining things like, "I don't know what I'm doing here. What is this all about? I'm not getting what I need." And so at that point, it's very easy for people just to wander off, because it's just not what I wanted. Well, when a student comes to me and complains about that, I say, "Oh, great. Now you're really going to get down to the real nitty gritty." See, there it is, the real nitty gritty. That song, yes. Get down to the real nitty gritty, you know, what it's really all about. That's what's happening at that point. Or boredom. I've had people say, "Oh, gosh, I just sit there and I'm so bored." Great. Great. That's a breakthrough. That means your daydreams are bumping up against reality. You're getting down to what's really going on in your life. And the truth of the matter is, you don't like the real nitty-gritty of your life. Why do I want to sit and face that? We're also addicted, I mean really addicted, to our daydream, to our delusions. Because that's what those are. They're escapes from facing what's really going on. So even while we're sitting here daydreaming about something called enlightenment, what we're really doing often underneath that is being dissatisfied that this is not encouraging those daydreams at all, about becoming something better, of being a better person, of having a better life. Everything comes down to, is my practice showing me a way to get what I want out of life? I mean, that's how we've been brought up to think. It's really quite natural. So this is not a put-down. I'm just saying, great, now we're getting down to really practicing with the reality of our life. And the great thing about reaching this point is what you've all heard about, you know, dualistic thinking, having a dualistic relationship to things. Well, here it is in bright neon lights right in front of you if you look at it closely. Because when you see, you begin to see your life clearly, and you see it without having to filter it through this business of what I want out of it, then you are truly practicing Zen. Then you are just sitting on your cushion right there in the midst of what your life actually is, without any of the frills, without the daydreams. And this is really getting through that barrier of dualistic attitude, which I'm fond of saying is, in this instance, which I think is the key one, shows just how crazy we are most of the time. Because what we have seen is that we think that I and my life are two different things. Whoa, think about it for a minute. There's dualism in a nutshell. I and my life are two different things. Well, I'll just leave you with that. But let me say that when you are really practicing and really sitting, you are your life right here, right now. That's who you are, is your life right here, right now. And your attempts to escape from it means escaping from life, period. Now, 10 minutes from now, the reality of your life, right then, right there, is also you. It's not the same you. I always spell that you in capital letters because that's how I and you usually resonate in our minds. You know, it's got little sparkles around it because this is the central issue, is it not? is I happy? Is you happy? And then, you know, if you really look even deeper, you ask the question, well, who is this you? Who is this I that I'm dealing with at this moment? Well, none of this that I'm talking about is really easy to come to. And it's extremely hard to accept at that level. After a while of hearing the Dharma, you get so you can sort of begin to cope with it with your thinking mind. But that's extremely shallow, a level of any kind of understanding. Zen understanding really is somewhere down around here. It's literally almost in your gut. It's in your whole, it's a whole body realization of the truth of your life, not just a mental picture of it. But at that point, even as that begins to happen, we're still deeply deluded and addicted to that delusion because we really would like to solve our life problems. And that's only natural. And we think we can do it by finding something in our practice at this point that will do that, that will cause some kind of a change in me that will automatically solve my problems. This is the old 1960s idea of what practice was all about. And it still is there in most of us that, well, if I just sit down and endure this long enough, unpleasant as it is, I will get enlightened. And then everything will be bright and wonderful. And my life will have gone where I wanted it to go. And I'm getting what I want out of life. It doesn't work that way. Now, we've heard the Four Noble Truths, the start of which is nirodha, cessation. That means we think that suffering is going to cease. But the Buddha never, ever, for one moment, promised us that this had anything to do with there would no longer ever be any catastrophes in our life. The stock market wouldn't fall apart on us and leave us gasping for breath. That there would be no more pain, no more suffering, no more old age, no more death. He never said that for a minute. Although I think sometimes our minds have translated that third noble truth into that. But no, that's not what he said. He said there's an end to suffering of the kind that occurs because we don't accept the fact of old age, sickness, and death as just a part of life and live our lives right there. It's the very trying to escape from these things that causes the kind of suffering that the Buddha was talking about. Now, as we continue to practice, we began to see that our life, that life in general is sort of like a kaleidoscope. It's constant change. And these patterns never repeat. But you know, this is a huge universe and everything in it is impinging on everything else and everything is in motion and everything is changing. So everything comes up. Everything comes up. Good, bad, indifferent, pain, suffering, joy. It all comes up. And that's all our life. Every bit of it. So this kaleidoscope can be sort of overwhelming because we don't see a path through it. But as a clear path, let's put it that way, through it. But as our practice deepens, we begin to see that this isn't chaos. There may be constant change, but there is a path. There is a way through it. There is an intelligent way to live this life in the midst of all this change and sometimes unpleasant circumstances. We begin to see that, well, whatever appears like the painful leg when you're sitting, where is it now? Oops. It's gone. The stock market is crashing. Well, somehow most of us will probably survive that. And sometime, 10 years in the future maybe, everybody will be going, yay, yay, we're getting rich again. Maybe even next year, you know, who knows? We don't know. But there is a pattern to all of this. Things arise and they cease, and they arise and they cease. And even that, in a way, is a delusion. So don't even cling to that. And what's more, we can never quite put our finger on where this begins and that ends. Where this is going and where that is going. There's somehow, it's just this flow. It's like a river flowing. With constant changes of the currents and eddies and things like that. And we never can quite pin anything down. And attempts to do that are bound to create suffering, sometimes intense suffering. And yet we find ourselves doing that too. You can see I did say this talk was going to be provocative. I'm going to give you the sort of the hard pummeling in a way with all of this. This all sounds like very bad news, but it's not. Because when you begin to experience this truth as your life, you'll begin to learn one of the great secrets of living your life, which is our constant attempts to change our life to fit what I want it to be is maybe not a very good approach. Even at that point, the impulse to do something about everything is very intense in us. We want it to be our way, and we want it to be our way now. Misery. Run around. Try to change things. Try to get it this way. Try to get it that way. And in the midst of this, everything changing. So maybe we're beginning to learn a little wisdom about stepping back and looking at it with a lot of wisdom instead of always rushing off to counteract that which we don't like and grab onto that which we like and think that that's going to be the solution to our life's problems. Now, this is sometimes hard for us to accept because sometimes in our frenzied trying to get our life the way we want it, it does go the way we want it for a while, for a little while. It goes that way. But it changes. And what we failed to look at the time when we did everything to make it go the way we wanted to was the price tag attached to our solution. So when we believe that there's something we can do that's going to hold back this constant flow of tides back and forth, sometimes going our way, sometimes going that way, we again have set ourselves up for retreating into delusion and away from actually living our life. But anyhow, in our delight at feeling that we're in control of life from time to time, and those are marvelous moments. Let's face it, they're marvelous. We're happy. Because things went our way. We got what we wanted, that house we dreamed about having. We got it. But that price tag will come to haunt us. Do I need to remind you to take a look around at the volcanic ash that's falling everywhere from this latest financial meltdown? It may not have hit you, but millions of people are losing homes, losing all their savings. It's part of life. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just the stock market went up and the stock market's going down. Buddhism 101. Now, don't think that I'm only talking about big issues. I'm talking about even the smallest things in your life. And I'm going to read you at the end of my talk a few paragraphs from this book, which really influenced my thinking on all of this. Years ago, it became a key influence on my Zen practice. But in it, he begins the section I'm going to read with telling you about a kind of disastrous example of all this, about a man, he gets sick, and he loses his job and all this stuff, and then what happens? But I thought, well, this is actually happening all the time in even the smallest ways, too. So I came up with a little example of the possible consequences of thoughtlessly indulging our need to change things, to get things the way we want them. Let's take cold. There's a famous koan about this one, by the way, but I'm not going to talk about that. You're tired of waking up in Northern California and it's cold. And all winter long it's cold and it's damp. Now, you've been to Arizona and you know that in the winter it's wonderfully warm there. So you think, well, my finances are good right now. I think I'll move to Arizona and I won't have to be cold anymore. And we make decisions on such silly things like this. Or it could be that I'll find the partner of my dreams if I just go to another place, or whatever it is. So anyhow, you go to all the expense and trouble to move to Arizona. And you found this little place in a new suburb of Phoenix. And, you know, that's where everybody is moving to Phoenix. So, everybody's moving to Phoenix. And you get there, and this little suburb looks amazingly just like suburban LA or Oakland or any place else, except that everything's adobe, except that it's fake adobe. That's okay. It looks interesting for a while. And so you settle down, and one of the first things you notice is that, gee, a lot of the year it's colder here than it is in San Francisco. But I'm not going to complain yet. I'm not going to complain yet, because the days are sunny and warm. And the desert air is so wonderful. That is, except when the wind is blowing, which seems to be an awful lot of the time. And then you're choking on dust. And could that be smog? Yeah, that's smog. Well, everybody else is moving here too. What did you expect? So then the winter is over, this marvelously sunny winter, and your bones really finally begin to warm up. And they warm up. And they warm up. And they continue to warm up. And so you realize that every day is going to be 110 outside. Not to worry. You close the windows and you close the door and you pull down the blinds and you turn on the air conditioner. And it's lovely in there, nice and cool. Of course, you do feel like you're living in a cave now, a prison maybe. And you're really not getting out there to see much of the desert, this beautiful desert you came all this way to enjoy. So then, you also find that the only way you can get out of there is run out getting in your air-conditioned car and driving to an air-conditioned store. So you can go shopping. Then you get in your car and you go back home and you stay in there until nightfall. And then it gets cold again. There is a little area right in there when it's just lovely. It's just perfect. So anyhow, do you like the story? I don't think I could get it published. Provocative, I says. So then, finally, your first electricity bill comes and you go, that air conditioning is very expensive. And your stock market takes a dive. And your mortgage company goes into receivership because you did take out a mortgage that's just really pushing what you can barely afford to pay. And the electricity tends to go off because there's too much electricity being used. And then you bake in your house. And then you go, is this it? Or in the words of Bobby Dylan, oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside of Mobile was the Memphis Blues again. And here you are with the Phoenix Blues. Anyhow, that's just a little example of what this little claustrophobic world of what I want and I need is really like. The whole thing is your own little drama in a closed room. Because what if we unfolded that thing and looked at it that I just gave you from the point of view of big mind, of the whole earth, of the universe, of what in Zen is sometimes called universal mind, big mind. You see that this isn't just a destructive way to live for yourself. It's destructive of the world. All that indulgence in air conditioning is creating enormous amounts of energy usage. It's causing the earth to warm up. It's causing the smog that's choking people. All these people rushing around here and there makes for crazy economic things going on. It has huge repercussions. It's not just my little world of I'm tired of being cold in the morning. Or if I just lived somewhere else, everything would be ducky. You feel properly provoked, I hope. Anyhow, a few years after Uchiyama Roshi's book, and I think this is the original edition, I went through two of these. came out, not too many years after it first came out, I just came on it by chance and read it, and it totally changed my practice, totally changed my way of looking at what my Zen practice was. And so I wanted to read a little section in this where he deals with the very thing that I'm talking about today. He says, the reason we find hell or unhappiness unbearable and run around longing to escape is because we cling so strongly to the desire for happiness. Traditionally in the East, this is seen as a demon making a plaything out of you in the same way a cat does to a mouse it has caught. Perhaps he puts us in a pot to boil, or chases us up a mountain of needles. We run about all confused, and the demon taunts us all the more with our own confusion. Or to offer a more modern-day example, a man's business fails, and then his wife falls ill. His child has a traffic accident, which causes a nervous breakdown. All his misfortunes seem to come at once, and in complete despair, he begins to struggle. And this is the word to keep in mind. Struggle. However, since everything, in this case, even misfortune, is our life, what is essential, especially in these circumstances, is to meet adversity with an attitude of equanimity. If we fall into hell, then we need resolve to see that hell is our home. When we are being boiled in the demon's cauldron, that is where we have to do zazen. When we are pursued up a mountain of needles, we should be willing to climb that mountain hand over hand, even at the risk of our life. When we throw all our life's energy into whatever we might encounter, no demon can help but retreat. What a way to live. Then he gives a quote from Rinzai's, the record of Rinzai's teaching, where he said, the self, and this is the big self, this universal self, far transcends all things. Even if the whole universe tumbles down, I would have no misgivings. Though all the Buddhas in the 10 directions might appear before me, I would not rejoice. Even though the 3 hells might appear before me, I would have no fear, since there is nothing I dislike. We view heaven or hell, enlightenment or delusion, all with the same eye. Or to put it more positively, we throw our whole lives into whatever we encounter, and that is the attitude living out the Buddha Dharma. Does anybody have any comments or questions about this? Any of this?
I have a question.
Sure. Yeah.
I guess what keeps coming back to me is the idea of something being broken and needing to fix it. And, you know, the easiest example is you have something on your house that the wind blows and it breaks. And then you can either leave it where it is and the house gradually crumbles and is destroyed, or you can fix it and keep going. And that analogy, I think, can be expanded pretty big to the point of, you know, basically my view right now is the way that we're doing things is profoundly breaking our house in the big picture. And you need to fix or not. You know.
Right. No, there's nothing wrong with what you're saying. This is the other side. Remember I said this was going to be one-sided. This is the other side. However, what we generally do is not sit down, let's say sit in Zazen and think when we get up from it, oh, the chimney's got a loose brick in it. I'd better get up there and fix that before it goes through my roof. Then, seeing clearly, we do. Or actually, I would call up somebody to come and do it for me. I wouldn't get on the ladder and go scrambling up the thing, I've got to fix that brick, because I'd probably wind up in the hospital. But anyhow, you deal directly with what really you can affect, and you don't run around trying to change that which you can't affect. Furthermore, you, like I say, step back, and you look at it from the wisdom of, well, now, there's easy ways to fix this problem, and there are difficult ways. But the difficult ways sometimes are less harmful of, let's say, life in general. This is what we're learning, you know, about green living is, well, maybe it's a little harder to do it this way, or maybe even cost a little bit more money, but we're not destroying the big picture by trying to fix the little picture. But until we see what I talked about in this talk, we can't do that. We tend to just run around, fix this, fix that, try to fix this, try to fix that. In other words, we're always trying to affect some kind of immediate change to get things to be the way we want it. And that really does not work. But if we don't take care of things, then we wind up, like you're saying, in a terrible pickle because we've daydreamed away our responsibility for our life and our world.
Band-aid fixes as opposed to attitude change.
Right, yeah.
In that very last part where you said something about where the Roshi said it's like he doesn't struggle, he just doesn't dislike anything, and that sort of keeps him on the path or whatever. I don't see how you can do that because, I mean, this day, like, I open the newspaper and I say things, not big things, but little things. You know, here's the mother and sister baby in the microwave, you know, and stuff like that. And that's, like, really disrupting to me. And it's like, I had sister go, oh, and sister turn the page in the paper. I mean, I look at it and go, God, this person is really disturbed. And, you know, that's really upsetting to me. So how do you handle, you know, there's always going to be that emotional place in yourself that is going to react.
Well, yes, to a certain extent, but how does it react? I mean, look at it from that point of view. Is this getting caught up in that? Yes, you have a reaction. Oh, somebody kills a baby. You know, yeah, that's horrifying. That punches buttons in our deepest being. But what do you do then? Rush off and screaming and to the telephone and call your senator and say, kill that woman, go get her, kill her, wring her neck, you know. But that's what people tend to do, you know. There are things like, you know, lynching parties and things like that where people, if you let this kind of reactiveness go, just let it go, it causes extremely serious consequences eventually. So, you know, you learn to not foist that off onto the world. You know, it's your pain. When you see that and you feel pain because of it, it's your pain. It's not something then you're going to force off on other people to have as their pain. You see what I'm saying?
But I think that's responsible.
Yeah.
And you can't help but sort of cast a pall on your life for a little while.
I think that's okay. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. See, we think maybe that shouldn't happen to us, but it will happen to us, and it does happen to us. You know, and in very serious ways, like our beloved parent dies, or our partner says, I can't stand you anymore, and takes off. You know, these things happen. And that is our life at that moment. That's what Rinzai was talking about. I fall into hell. That's what he's saying. If I fall into hell, I still got to go ahead and lead my life. How am I going to meet this? That's the big question. How am I going to meet the circumstances of my life? Not how I'm going to escape from them. That's really what I'm talking about in this talk. That we really need to, what we really learn from our practice is how to meet our lives, not to how to escape our lives.
Should we get that example of Holly Barts? I think that's kind of a universal issue of the existence of suffering. And the newspapers just brings it to your attention in a black and white format. Is it, could it be said that the horror that's there, it's going to be there every day.
Oh, yeah.
It's continuously there. Even if it's not in the newspaper, somebody is still killing a baby somewhere in the world. It's always happening. But at the same time, everything else is always happening, too.
Right.
It's that maintenance of understanding the totality of all things happening all the time that gets us through being hung up on falling into the horror, falling into that cauldron of that one article about the baby that can be so depressing.
Yeah. You know, this is what basically, this question of Holly's is what brought the Buddha to his pursuit of the path. Because he went out and he saw, you know, old age and sickness and death. And something in him said, no, 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 that can't be life. No, 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 life is wonderful, because it was for him. He was protected. He lived like we've been living through this really up period, you know, where, it seems like everything was wonderful and everything was great and you could get whatever you wanted, you could do whatever you wanted to do. And suddenly he looked out the window and he saw, oops, that ain't the way it is. And life is He says this. He actually used these words. Life is suffering. I've always found that one hard to stomach.
I'll tell you a little story. This week's little story for me is, many of you know I wore skunks. I had a skunk for 8 years. Patience was her name. She had with these ended. And she was an extremely important figure in my life in my 20s and 30s. We adored each other. And so she skunked in my totem. Now, black and white stripes work. But I, not very many, you know, some people like them, some don't. Well, I remember saying not long ago to someone who's, we were talking about animals that we were like, well, otters. And I said, well, can you imagine what it's like to see this animal that you really love, your totem animal, most often squashed on the road?
Yeah.
And I thought about that, and he would sort of say, he hadn't thought about it that way, so he thought about it that way. And I've always learned from Tagore Roshi this. I always stop and sort of, and I'm trying not to take both hands off the wheel. I bow every dead animal, right? But the skunks have a special place for me. So, yes, some things touch us more deeply than others. I just don't happen to be as moved by dead opossums as by dead skunks. And I accept this reality in my life, but it does extend more even to the apostle, which is ever find so appealing because of my connection to the dead skunk. But I still, I suffer for every single dead skunk, and then I finally realized that I'm a skunk bodhisattva. That I'm certain my self-appointed job to mourn every dead skunk I see. That someone should be particularly mourning. You know, every someone else should be the apostle bodhisattva. So I'll be the skunk, I will choose that suffering. Right? It's a very small example, but I would choose that particular pang, a real pang, and let it be a pang for every dead skunk I see. And that is a good thing. And it crosses my heart to the other dead animals, to the living animals, and so forth. But it is a suffering. And that part of our sense of the bodhisattva path is a kind of voluntarily taken up. It's not about being callous. Even though it really is unpleasant, keep that subscription to the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's that keeping our showing up and seeing it. So, we in that sense, we embrace suffering that is already there. Say, my God, people kill babies in microwaves. No, I'm not going to try to get a law changed. I really want to see what I do this like that. Not what somebody else does. Where do I have some impact is what I do that's kind of like a baby in a microwave and turning on the button because I don't know. The poor people who were burned in a fire, the electricity was turned off, and so they put Coleman fuel in a kerosene lamp and it exploded. They didn't know. You know. So I wanted, what do I not know? I want to be affected. And sometimes I'm overwhelmed. I don't want to be overwhelmed. I don't want to be overwhelmed, Jeff. I want you to fix the skunk issue, not the baby issue. Not the president elect, because those are too big for me. But I'm going to still try to show up for them. But no, it's not, we don't want to be callous. We want to be the skunk bodhisattva in our own prediction. Yes, this week.
And it's all the same. It's hot. It's cold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's discomfort. And we don't want discomfort.
Right.
No matter what color it comes in, or what story it comes in, or it's unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Discomfort is unpleasant. So we claim discomfort.
And we're destroying the world just to get a little comfort.
We bring that discomfort. We don't want. We're destroying the newspaper. We eat it. It's cold. You know, the stock market crash, whatever that is, we cling to comfort.
Yeah.
But it's really all the same.
It's clean.
Hmm.
Not me.
Okay, if anybody.
Beings are numberless. I bow to freedom. Illusions are inexhaustible. I bow to end them. Dharma gates are infinite. I bow to enter them. The Buddha way is boundless. I bow to realize it.
We have a couple of them, but I have one of them, I think.
Yeah.
And some of study group starting, I sent an email out, but not anyone may have gotten it.